Crime and Crime Again is a true crime podcast containing subject matter that may be graphic or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. In 1980, the tiny town of Mobridge, South Dakota, was home to just over 4,000 people, and it's home to even fewer people today. Just over the bridge across the Missouri River, in the unincorporated community of Kennel, South Dakota, 18-year-old Candace Roughsurface lived with her 2-year-old son, Homer, and her mother, Alberta, who helped Candace care for him. Kennel is nestled right next to the Missouri River and sits on the eastern edge of the Standing Rock Reservation. The reservation itself is roughly twice the size of Delaware and stretches across the border between North and South Dakota. Candace Roughsurface was a Lakota Sioux woman from Standing Rock. Born on October 18, 1961, Candace, or as her family affectionately knew her, Candy, was the second youngest of several children. News reports have differed in clarifying exactly how many siblings Candace had. Some articles say there were 8 children in the family, other articles say 12. Needless to say, she grew up in a big family. During her sophomore year of high school, Candace had a relationship with a boy from Standing Rock named Tommy, and she became pregnant. Ultimately, she dropped out of high school to finish her pregnancy and care for her baby boy. By 1980, when Candace was 18 years old, she was the only one out of her siblings living at home with her mother, but she didn't mind. She appreciated and enjoyed having help with Homer while she worked. Candace was a hard worker. Her ultimate dream was to save money, go back to school, and try to make a good life for her son. At the time, she was working a housekeeping job at the local college, across the river in Mobridge. She had also decided to start working toward earning her high school diploma. On Friday, August 2nd, 1980, Candace picked up her paycheck and headed home to Kennel for a while to see Homer. After he was settled for the night, she decided to go out into town for a few drinks with her sister Clara. At the time, many local bars wouldn't bat an eye at serving beer to 18-year-olds. Candace said goodnight to her mother, and she and Clara headed back across the river into Mobridge. The night was going well for Candace, until she and Clara met up with Clara's boyfriend at a local bar called the Silver Dollar Saloon. The couple seemed to be in their own little world, and Candace started to feel like she was intruding. So eventually, she parted ways with her sister and headed to another bar in town called Joker's Wild. The next morning, August 3rd, Alberta awoke to find that Candace hadn't come home the night before. It wasn't unusual for Candace to stay with a friend after a night out, but typically she would return home in time to care for Homer when he woke up. Knowing that Candace had left the night before with her sister Clara, Alberta called Clara to find out if Candace was still with her. But Clara hadn't seen or heard from her sister since the night before, when Candace left the Silver Dollar Saloon. Clara started asking around, trying to find out where Candace was last seen in town that night. Eventually, she heard that Candace had been at Joker's Wild after leaving the Silver Dollar, and that's the last place anyone had seen her. 3 days after Candace was last seen, Alberta made the decision to report her daughter missing to the Mobridge police. But, as she expected, they tried to dismiss her and turn her away. Alberta was met with indifference, fueled by racist stereotypes. But she persisted, and the Mobridge police ultimately did take her report for Candace. Police did speak with people who may have been at the Joker's Wild the night Candace disappeared, but weren't able to obtain any further information about where Candace may have gone or who she may have been with. Police also spoke with Tommy, the father of Candace's 2-year-old son, but he hadn't been anywhere near the bar that night and hadn't spoken to Candace in some time. However, beyond the bare minimum of questioning a few people, very little was done by police to try to locate Candace. Her case went cold. On May 19, 1981, a ranch hand named Steve Sheldon was making his rounds, checking on things around his boss's property, when he discovered something disturbing in a shallow bay of Lake Oahe. The water had receded and revealed a body, badly decomposed and lodged in the mud. Sheldon immediately called the Mobridge police. When police arrived, they found 5 bullets underneath the body, all from a .22 caliber weapon. And nearby, they found the confirmation they needed, a pair of glasses with the name Candy inscribed on them. After more than 9 months, they had found Candace Roughsurface. But once again, their investigation wouldn't get much further than this. Candace's family would be without answers for 15 years. In October 1995, 15 years after Candace's murder, a woman from Eagle River, Wisconsin, called the Mobridge police. Her daughter was in the middle of a contentious divorce, and the woman had a secret to share about her soon-to-be former son-in-law. Several years before this, a man named James Stroh had confided to his wife that in 1980, he was involved in the rape and murder of a native girl in Mobridge, South Dakota. Fast forward 15 years, Stroh and his wife were getting a divorce, and his mother-in-law decided to come forward with his secret. The woman also told Mobridge police that it wasn't just James Stroh that was involved in Candace's murder. Stroh had acted at the behest of his cousin, Nicholas Scher. Nicholas Scher was not an unfamiliar name to police. He was briefly interviewed a few days after Candace disappeared, but they weren't able to link him directly to Candace. Now, 15 years later, James Stroh was ready to tell police his story. According to Stroh, on the night of August 2, 1980, he and Nicholas Scher decided to go out for the night to celebrate Stroh's last night in town. He'd been visiting South Dakota from Wisconsin with his family. At the time, Stroh was 15 and Scher was 16. That night, the two teenagers found themselves at the Joker's Wild Bar with a group of other teenage boys. It was there that they ran into Candace. Eventually, the group decided to move their celebrations to a party at a local ranch, and Nicholas Scher invited Candace to go along with them. Though Candace had never really interacted with Scher, she knew of him because he was good friends with her cousin, Rusty. The party was on a ranch just outside of Mobridge, at a mobile home owned by Steve Sheldon, the man who had found Candace's body in May 1981. Stroh told police that one of the boys in the group was being too forward with Candace, and it upset her, though he didn't specify who exactly was making advances. It's possible that it could have been Nicholas Scher. According to the episode of Swamp Murders that covered Candace's case, Candace wanted to leave the party but had to catch a ride with Scher and Stroh. The episode depicted Scher making repeated advances toward Candace while they're in the truck, and Candace became angry with him. She struck Scher in the face, which unleashed his temper. Scher pulled the truck over in a field and dragged Candace out, throwing her to the ground. In an article by Anita Parlow, published by the Washington Post on May 3, 1996, Stroh is quoted from his testimony. Quote, "Nick slammed on the brakes and got out of the truck, came around to my side and told me we were going to do her." End quote. Scher proceeded to brutally beat and rape Candace, and then ordered Stroh to do the same. Nicholas Scher then walked back to his truck and grabbed a .22 caliber rifle. He shot Candace four times, and then put the rifle in Stroh's hand, ordering him to pull the trigger, and he did. In total, Candace was shot five times in both the back and the head. The teenagers then stole the money that Candace had in her purse. Scher was concerned about getting blood in the back of his truck, so he and Stroh opted to wrap chains around Candace's legs and chain her to the bumper of Scher's truck. They then drove off, dragging her almost a mile to the river's edge. The next day, they returned to bury her, hiding her body in the mud, where she wouldn't be found until 9 months later. After concealing the evidence of the murder, James Stroh left Mobridge with his family to return home to Wisconsin. For 10 years, Stroh carried this secret until he shared it with his wife. Police were able to record a telephone conversation between Stroh and Scher, during which Nicholas Scher admitted to his involvement in the murder of Candace Roughservice. Because Stroh cooperated with police, he faced far lesser charges than Scher. After pleading guilty to second-degree manslaughter and assault, Stroh was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Meanwhile, in January 1996, after pleading not guilty and having a trial date set, Nicholas Scher was released from custody on a $200,000 bond. He was charged only with first-degree murder. The rape charges had been dropped due to the statute of limitations being up. At the time, Scher was 31 years old and working as a diesel mechanic. On May 7, 1996, just before the trial was set to begin, the case took a complete turn. Nicholas Scher took a plea deal. He pleaded guilty to first-degree manslaughter in exchange for having a chance at parole. He was sentenced to 100 years in prison, but would be eligible for parole after only 13 years. The case deepened the blatant racism in Mobridge. Many of the town's white residents appeared to believe the native residents were intentionally trying to create an even worse racial divide by simply rallying for justice for Candace. In that same Washington Post article by Anita Parlow, dated May 3, 1996, one woman is quoted having said, quote, "The Indians wouldn't be so upset if the accused were Indian," end quote. And in an article by Brian Bonner, published by the Seattle Times on March 17, 1996, a local shopkeeper, who refused to state his name, said, quote, "These Indians, they kill each other all the time anyway. If they don't, they get drunk and freeze to death. It's kind of an everyday thing," end quote. He refused to allow his name to be released out of fear that his racist statement would drive away his regular native customers. The Rough Surface family's fight for justice had already been grueling, and the battle seemed to be unrelenting. James Stroh was released from prison in October 2004, and for more than two decades, Nicholas Scher applied for parole at every opportunity he could. On April 17, 2019, after serving 23 years in prison, Nicholas Scher was granted parole. He was released from prison in May 2019. Homer Rough Surface, Candace's son, now 44 years old, did not learn about Scher's parole until a month after it was granted. He was never contacted by authorities to alert him. In an interview with Aberdeen News in May 2019, Homer said, quote, "Nobody contacted me about it, not even the court or anything," end quote. He continued, quote, "To not even be notified, it seems that I should have had some kind of warning so I could prepare for something like this," end quote. Nicholas Scher died of cancer in April 2021. The glaring truth of the murder of Candace Rough Surface is that, though her killers were caught and served time for their crimes, Candace did not get her justice. From the lack of urgency in searching for her in the first few days after she disappeared, to the suffering her family endured for 15 years after her body was found, and even beyond that, her killers were granted leniency in more ways than one. One of them was released only 9 years after his arrest, and the other was ultimately granted parole, despite being sentenced to 100 years in prison. The horrifying truth is that Candace's murderers would not have rallied sympathetic supporters or been offered plea bargains had they been Native. This injustice is the devastating reality when it comes to missing and murdered Indigenous people. Indigenous women face homicide rates 10 times higher than the national average, and yet their names do not make headlines. Please take the time to learn their names, their faces, and their stories. All sources for this episode are listed in the show notes. Please be sure to leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. My Good Pods page will also be linked in the show notes. There, you can rate and review individual episodes, and you can also see what podcasts I've been listening to. You can follow the podcast on Twitter, at CrimeAgainPod, on Instagram, at CrimeAgainPodcast, and on TikTok, at CrimeAgainPodcast. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode of Crime and Crime Again.